2 Corinthians chapter 9 will be the place in God's Word that we give our attention to for the next 3 weeks in a short series, which comes as a sequel to the sequel. So just to back up really quickly, you'll recall if you were here that last fall we looked at the first 19 chapters of the book of Exodus in a series I called Exiting Egypt. It was Israel's deliverance from slavery, which is given to us allegorically to show how God can give us our liberty from the enslavements to various passions and pleasures by which otherwise we are bound. And then it seemed appropriate to launch a series out of Exiting Egypt called Liberty for Life, which was a series on the Ten Commandments, because that's where God took his people. Once he granted them liberty, he gave them his law. And we saw the Ten Commandments, I think, as a code or instruction as to how to capitalize on this opportunity for liberty. Out of these two series comes a second sequel called Time to Sow. And in this three-week opportunity, looking specifically at what Paul the Apostle says in 2 Corinthians 9, I want to show you a biblical principle, a Bible idea that can change a life. And I know that's true because to a degree it's changed my life, though I've been challenged as I've looked at this chapter to see that there are still some changes that could happen. But I know that this church exists in the first place and continues to exist all these decades after it was started because of the number of people who are here this morning or will be here at 11 o'clock who grasp the concept, the biblical principle, this idea that changes the life and have had their lives changed by it and are now changing the lives of others. It's a principle which is communicated here in 2 Corinthians 9 and in other places in Scripture by an analogy about sowing seed and watching that seed grow and then reaping a harvest. This is a biblical principle that can change a life. And to the degree that it continues to change lives here, our church will continue to be a life-changing center where other lives will be changed. We live in a city with all kinds of people who need to know what kind of change can come through the power of God. We are nicely positioned here in Wonderland Road to do this changing, to be these changers. And whether or not we grow to be that kind of church depends entirely on how many of us grasp the concept about sowing seed and reaping harvest. Now, very quickly, I want to give you two bits of background information so you understand what we've got here in 2 Corinthians chapter 9. And there are study guides. Some of you know this already. They are on the website to be downloaded, or hard copies are in the foyer as I speak, and you can do some work ahead of time. You could have done work ahead of time for this, and one of the sheets of Bible study material gives you the background information. Let me tell you what you missed if you didn't do it. Here's one little bit of background information, the historical context, which is being referred to in the first five verses of 2 Corinthians 9, which I leave you to read. Here's the deal. At the time when this letter was written, 56 AD, there was a crisis in the Christian church, that is, all the churches that existed at that point, because the mother church, that is, the church in Jerusalem, was filled with people who were basically starving. Because a huge famine or several famines had swept through the land, and the Jerusalem church, for some reasons particular to them, were not at all prepared to cope with a famine. They had no savings. You can read it for yourself in the book of Acts. And so they were starving. And so churches like the church in Corinth, to which Paul is writing, were in the position to do some good for the mother church. You know, they were daughter churches, and the people back of the mother church were starving. So Paul the Apostle was on assignment here to try to scrounge up some money from churches like the church in Corinth to meet the needs of Christians living in another part of the world, in a significant other part of the world. This ninth chapter is about the Corinthian church getting in on this opportunity. And it was a financial opportunity. It was all about them giving money so that the people in Jerusalem would have food to eat. But what I want you to see is that the opportunity, which had everything to do with money in 2 Corinthians 9, was an illustration of an opportunity of all sorts that doesn't necessarily have to do with money, but might. Money's not the only thing we can use to do something for God, but it was the thing that Paul was asking the Corinthians to use to do something for God in regard to the hungry Christians in Jerusalem. That's the first bit of background information. Here's the second. This is something I'm going to assume you are real clear on, and my assumption is based on the fact that you've heard it from me a lot. So here's the assumption, that you know that the New Testament concept of what sort of good God works out the details of our lives to accomplish is Christ-likeness. I hope this is familiar to you. It'd be really, you know, thrilling to me to have people say, yeah, yeah, we're really clear on that, because you never stop talking about it. So here's the deal. Romans 8:28, you know, famous wall plaque says, all things work together for good to those who love God and are called according to His purpose. And then the next verse, verse 29, explains what that good is. So the background information is the New Testament concept of what sort of good God works out the details of our lives to accomplish. And the sort of good that God is manipulating the details of our lives to accomplish is the good of becoming more like Jesus. This is what we are destined to be conformed to. This is what we have been predestined to be conformed to, the image of Christ. Need to know that. God is in the business of shaping the details of your life, manipulating the details of your life for this particular good, that you would become more like Jesus. That's what you needed to know. And I assume you do. So now let's move on. I've got three notes this morning, and we will accumulate notes over the next 2 weeks as we continue to make 2 Corinthians 9 our business. Notes, here's number one. This is just to say that again. God intends that His people become conformed to the image of Christ. Pardon me, well, I feel like jumping up and down about this, and I won't. But this is really important. God intends for each of us who are His people to become more and more conformed to the image of Christ. In 2 Corinthians chapter 9, this is referred to as if the Corinthians already knew about it. Let me show you in verses 8 to 10, these phrases. Paul's talking in 2 Corinthians 9 about these people abounding in every good work. And I think that he knew that they didn't need to ask, what do you mean? What kind of good work? Because he would understand that they understood that they were being conformed to the image of Christ, and the good work which they were to abound in was the good work of Christ-like behavior, the sorts of good works that Jesus did, reaching out and changing lives. Then later on in that same little passage, we see the phrase, His righteousness endures forever, and that's definitely the righteousness of God. It's a quotation. But the righteousness of God is manifested in the righteousness of Christ, so it's also Christ-likeness, so that later on, in verse 10, when Paul says this, increase the harvest of your righteousness, he's talking about the harvest of being righteous, the harvest of Christ-likeness. And the harvest of righteousness is not only a reference to the conformity to the image of Christ going on in our lives, which is what God intends to do, but it also refers to the kind of harvest we have in other people's lives. When we have an impact on other people and they become more Christ-like because of our influence, then that's our harvest of righteousness as well. Paul, I think, assumes the Corinthians know this stuff, and I'm assuming you know this stuff, and that's the first note just to remind you. So let's be clear on this. God, who rules the world and holds the world in His hand and has total authority and power to change every detail of your life, has one thing on His mind in regard to all those who love Him and are called according to His purpose. Many of you say, well, I think that's me. You'd say, I think I'm one of those people. I think I'm one of His people called according to His purpose. Well, you need to know that when God looks at all the details of your life and thinks about how He could change those details, He's got one thing on His mind. Not just one thing, but He's got this one thing on His mind. You becoming more like Christ. That's what He means to be doing. Which is sort of the universal answer to the question, why is this happening to me? And I know some of you ask that question very painfully in regards to some real difficulties you're going through. Why is this happening to me? And the crazy simplicity is that whatever else could be said in answer to that question, there's always this answer first, because God has destined you to become like Christ. These are the details of His prescription for your Christ-likeness. That's the first note. Here's the second. Coming out of the first, note two. God determines what you get and how much you get and when you get it and how you get it. God's totally in control of every detail of your life and all the things you get. There's a reference to this in verse 8 of 2 Corinthians 9 when Paul says, God is able. God is able to make all grace abound to you, so that having all sufficiency in all things at all times, you may abound in every good work. Now there's that phrase, every good work, and I've tried to show you already that he means the good work of Christ-like behavior, the good work that comes from being like Christ. And God is able to give you all the grace, all the undeserved help you need to be the person who does the good work that He has created you to do. God determines what you get and how much you get and when you get it and how you get it. And this is a truth that doesn't just pop up unexpectedly in 2 Corinthians 9. This is from cover to cover in the Bible. We've already looked at what David prayed in 1 Chronicles 29. Let's look at it again. Here's what David, a man after God's own heart, knew about God. He says, "Both riches and honor come from you, and you rule over all. In your hand are power and might, and in your hand it is to make great and to give strength to all." David was doing great at that time. David was very strong at that time, and he was right and humble to say, "It's in your hand to make great and to give strength to all." So then he thanks God. Of course he should. "And now we thank you, our God, and praise your glorious name." Now this is at the time in his life when he's about to present to God all the materials out of which his son Solomon would build the temple. And he looks at all that he's been able to do out of his greatness as a king and his strength as a leader, and he says, "But who am I? And what is my people that we should be able thus to offer willingly?" You know, that we've able to give all this to you. "For all things come from you, and of your own have we given you." All this stuff that David had to give to God was stuff that God gave to him so that he could give it to God. This is an Old Testament understanding, which is followed by a New Testament understanding. And James, leader of that church in Jerusalem, writing to his Christian brothers and sisters scattered throughout the Roman Empire, says, James chapter 1, "Do not be deceived, my beloved brethren." If you don't get this, you're still deceived. "Don't be deceived, my beloved brothers. Every good gift and every perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights, with whom there's no variation of shadow due to change." Every good thing you've got, if it's good, every perfect thing that you've got, if it's really perfect, came from the same place. It came from above. It came from the Father of lights. This is true of each one of us. God determines what you get and how much you get and when you get it and how you get it. And the lively question is, how does He determine that? Like, how come, if all of us who are called according to His purpose are all destined to become conformed to the image of Christ, how come some of us get so much of some stuff while others don't get very much of that same stuff? How does God determine how much of the stuff He gives you to give you? And how does He determine when? And we know the answer to that. Everything that comes into your life is part of God's plan for your Christ-likeness if you believe in Jesus, if you are one who is called according to His purpose. It's what God has on His mind. And He has many ways to get us to Christ-likeness, which is good because He has many children. And if you've got more than one child, you know there's no two children alike. You've got to treat each of your children differently if you're going to treat them well, because they're all different and need different things, and this is what God the Father is doing for us. And in order for us to understand this, that what we have in our lives and what has come to us has come to us for our Christ-likeness particularly, we need to be looking for the things that God is asking us to look for. We need to change, in some cases, our mindset. This is what Paul calls the Colossians to. He says to us, he says to the Colossians, and the Holy Spirit through him says to us, "If then you have been raised up with Christ," if it's real, if you really are His person, if you have been raised up with Christ, "seek the things that are above, where Christ is, seated at the right hand of God. Set your mind on things above, not on things that are on earth. For you've died, and your life is hidden with Christ in God. When Christ, who is your life, appears, then you also will appear with Him in glory." So we should all be setting our mind on things above, and setting our minds on Christ, the person who's above, setting our mind on His intention of us becoming replicas of Him here in this world. Little Christs, little Christlets, that's what the word Christian means. And the point is, if we don't get this, then we won't understand why things have come to us. We won't understand why God has given us the stuff He's given us. If we don't understand why He's given it to us, we won't know what to do with what He's given us. And that could lead to the shocking common reality, and it's shocking anyway, but it's really shocking when you consider how common it is for a person wasting her life, wasting his life. And you see how this idea of getting the right mindset, getting your mind set on the things above, is absolutely essential for us not to waste our lives. Because if you misunderstand what you exist for, if you misunderstand what God has brought you to Himself for, and just carry on enjoying life or seeking to enjoy it, you could spend your whole life pursuing things that you think constitute a pleasant life. And there's two ways this could go, both of them disastrous. I mean, there's more than two, but here's two disasters. You could spend your whole life pursuing a goal, pursuing a lifestyle that you never quite get, but you're such a persevering person that you never give up. And you strive for it all your life. And it's not what God has called you to be. It's not what He's called you to live for. But you try not to be bothered by that, and you pursue this thing, and because you never quite make it, you never stop pursuing it, and then you get to the end of your life, and I'm assuming there's a great deal of clarity that comes from that experience. When you stand before your judge and maker, and you look into the face of God, and you see it's the face of Jesus, and realize that you've been called to be like Him, and realize that you haven't devoted your life to becoming like Him, and you look back on what you did pursue, though you never attained, and you say about yourself, I had one life, and I wasted it. And the other disaster would be for you to be kind of successful in pursuing the sort of life you are after. So every year you make a little bit of a gain, and every year you get a little closer to your goal, just enough to taste how good it is. So you never catch on to the fact that you're living for the wrong thing, because it's satisfying enough for what you are really longing for. And so you live your whole life glad to be doing so well. And then you get to the end and you look back and you say, one life, and I've wasted it. This important issue of using your life for the purposes for which it's been given is what Paul was writing to the Corinthians about. So back up to chapter 4, and we see Paul saying in what we call the conclusion of chapter 4, Paul writes to the Corinthians, we look not to the things that are seen, but to the things that are unseen. For the things that are seen are transient, but the things that are unseen are eternal. And he has more to say about that in chapter 5 and 6 and 7 and 8. And then he gets to chapter 9 and our actual text, which is verse 10, where he says that God is the one who supplies seed to the sower and bread for food. This God who supplies seed to the sower and bread for food will supply and multiply your seed for sowing and increase the harvest of your righteousness. And this is our third note. You can put it down this way. This is the biblical idea that can change a life. Note 3. God supplies seed for bread and multiplies seed for sowing. This is the biblical principle. That God is both a supplier and a multiplier. He supplies seed for bread and He multiplies seed for sowing. This is the principle. This is the foundational, life-changing truth. Let's look at the verse in its completeness. Verse 10, He who supplies seed to the sower and bread for food will supply and multiply your seed for sowing and increase the harvest of your righteousness. God is the one who gives us seed with two things in mind, that we would have bread, that we would have a harvest. Now, Paul is talking about money, so I will too, but it's not the only thing that we can apply this principle to. But money is one of the commodities that God gives us, and the money that He gives us is like seed. And you can use the seed for bread, or you can use it for sowing. But money's not the only thing God gives us, and we're missing the principle's application if we think it is. Because in addition to the money that comes into our lives, which is a gift of God, so is the gift of time. God gives us time. Both the length of your life and the amount of time you have free in the living of your life to either make bread or sow for harvest. Time is a gift of God. And we all get exactly the same amount, you know, plainly, 168 hours a week. But have you noticed that some people have a whole lot more time to, you know, serve God, a whole lot more time to impact people than other people? You, for example? God is the one who gives you as much time as you have to use for the purposes for which He's given it to you. And that's why I call this series, Time to Sow. Get it? Time? You can sow time for a harvest, or you can just use it to make bread. And time is not the only other thing. So could we talk about energy? Energy is a gift of God. It's in His hand to give strength, to make great. Have you noticed that he's given more strength to some people than others? There are some people who are just way more energetic than me or you or other people who might come to mind. There are some people who are just really able to hit it hard. And what's the explanation? Well, we've already seen the explanation. God gives us what we get, how we get it, when we get it for his purposes. Energy is a gift of God. And then, well, life isn't fair. Another sort of seed that God puts in our hands is our abilities. And plainly, life isn't fair. Some people have way more abilities than other people. Some people are up to way more accomplishment than others because they have so many abilities. Some people are really, really good at things. But the same principle applies. Those of us who have any kind of talents at all have gifts of God. It's like seed that God's put into our hands. And we can use it to make bread, or we can use it to sow for a harvest of righteousness. And I could go on and on, but let me do one more that I think fits what the Bible is speaking to us here about. We need to see that God also gives us opportunities. Opportunities are gifts of God. I think, in fact, when Paul is talking about opportunities, he often uses the word open door. And check it out sometime. 2 Corinthians chapter 2, a very interesting thing he says about an open door. God gives him an open door, and he chooses not to go through it. It's like a seed that came into his hand, and he chooses not to go through it without embarrassment. It's really interesting. 2 Corinthians chapter 2, check it out sometime. So here's here's a list of things that the seed refers to, and we're going to look at this for the next 2 weeks. So I was thinking it would be really good if we could sort of keep a handle on this, money, time, energy, abilities, opportunities. So I was trying to think, the last couple of weeks, getting ready for today, what I could give you as a sort of mnemonic aid, memory tool, so that we remember this. So I started, fooling around with the word, and I'm thinking about the first letter of each word. I think I'll just spell some stuff here. I could spell meat. There's still a vowel left, or I spell, oh, meat. And it doesn't do it, does it? But so I looked some more. I could spell team. There's no I in team, but there's an O. I have to go, oh, team. Remember, folks, Teemo. And that's not doing it for me either. So I keep working on it, right? And then I see something I hadn't seen before. You can move it around. And you can spell a name. The name is Mateo. Look at that. Mateo. Well, that sounds cool to me, because the only Mateo I know is a cool little kid. But it gets better, because I Wikipedia the name, of course I do, and see that it means the very same thing that the more English name Matthew means. It means gift of the Lord. Whew! This is something I could live with. Mateo. It means gifts of the Lord. It means the money and the time and the energy and the abilities and the opportunities God gives us to make bread or to harvest righteousness. So here's what we've got. We've got God revealing himself as the provider of seed. He gives us gifts. He's given us a lot of gifts. We are one of the richest countries in the world. So even those of us who don't have much money are, by global standards, rich. We've got lots of money. And we've got time. But I was going to say that third now. We've got abilities. And we've got time to use some of those abilities. And we've got some energy. And we've got some opportunities. These are the gifts of God. This is the seed he puts into our hands. And here's what he's telling us in this principle, which we call note 3. God is the supplier, and he might be the multiplier. Jesus taught us to pray, give us this day our daily bread. There's nothing wrong with bread. You need bread, and bread, of course, means the food you need so as not to starve. It's the need for bread in Jerusalem that motivated Paul to motivate the Corinthians to send money to Jerusalem. Nothing wrong with bread. In fact, you need bread, you need food to live. And God tells us to pray, give us this day our daily bread, and expect him to supply it. And he does. And along with the stuff of which our bread is made, that would be, the money that he has given us to buy groceries with, and the abilities that he's given us to get a job, to make the money, to buy the stuff that the bread is made of, and the energy and the opportunity, all of that He's given us, He has given us the ability to do more than just eat bread. But as you trust God to supply you with the stuff you need to live the life you're living, there's a biblical principle that can change your life. If you catch on to the fact that He who supplies seed for bread, that is, you know, all the stuff by which we survive physically, He who supplies seed for bread will multiply that seed if you've got anything in mind to do more than just eat bread. And now I don't just mean eating all the food you need, although we can easily eat more than we need, but all the other things that are just like, you know, just as spiritually significant as eating bread when you're hungry. A person could devote his whole life, you know this, a person could devote her whole life to doing nothing but what is the equivalent of eating bread. You'll live your whole life just, you know, doing what feels good. And for some people it is just food, and they're very food-oriented, and that's all they're really looking for. And if they've got a lot of food, they're perfectly happy. And when we understand a food obsession for starving people, but once you're past starving, a food obsession is kind of a waste of life, don't you think? And it's not food that some people are obsessed with. But similarly, some people are just looking to use everything they got, you know, all their money, all their abilities, all their time, all their energy, making use of every opportunity to enjoy life in regard to what they think is most pleasurable. And honestly, there are some people who really don't care about much more than just good food and good drink or good drugs or good sex or good sports or good relaxation, good time logged in the entertainment center. I mean, there are some people who are just using everything God has supplied for their own bread. And if you wonder, you know, what does God think of that? Does God punish that? I would think in actual fact, what we should see is that that sort of life is its own punishment. You just live for the moment, and you pile up your moments till all the moments are gone, and who's going to say, that was great. I ate a lot of bread. Good bread. 7-grain bread, 12-grain bread. Pumpernickel bread. I mean, people could live their whole lives quite happy with all that they enjoyed. But I'm thinking it's going to look really different a few moments after they die, when they stand before their Creator and their Judge and see that it's Jesus and come to understand that everything that was given to them was given so that they could become more Christ-like, and not just that, so that they could help other people become more Christ-like. And God was supplying them with some seed for that. And the principle is that when you catch on to that and realize that you'd like to use your gifts, your mateo, your gifts of God for more than just eating bread, but you'd like to sow some of that money and some of that ability and some of that time using the opportunities God gives you, He will multiply the seed. He'll give you more and more and more, so that you can expect more money from God if you'll use your money, not just to buy bread, but to buy someone else bread if it's a physical need you see you need to meet to be like Christ. Or other things you could do with your money, or your abilities, your time, or your energy, your opportunities. Now, if this is starting to sound to you like the prosperity gospel, and I'm beginning to sound like a prosperity gospel preacher, I would say, glad you noticed. Because you know what? As wrong as the prosperity gospel is, it's not all wrong. That is, it's not wrong to try to enlighten people about the fact that God means for us to prosper. He does mean for us to prosper. He means for us to experience a great harvest. What's wrong with the prosperity gospel and the prosperity gospel preachers is not the idea of encouraging prosperity. What's wrong is the superficial, worldly, materialistic, ungodly, stupid idea of what prosperity is, according to people who think that God has brought us into the world so that we can experience bling. Lots of jewelry, lots of medallions. So if anybody, you know, spreads the word out there that Wilkins, who's always been kind of known for quirky doctrine, has now gone into the prosperity gospel, you can say, I didn't see any extra jewelry on him, just the one wedding ring. The prosperity that God's calling us to is real. But more real than what the prosperity gospel people say about how, you know, we should expect God to give us lots of money and lots of pleasures and lots of stuff. But this takes a new mindset. So I think about how the book of Psalms starts and the damage we do ourselves when we get counsel from the wrong places. So Psalm 1 says, blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel of the wicked. The wicked will counsel you all wrong on this. Nor stands in the way of sinners. If you stand in the way of sinners, sinners will have an influence on you. Or sits in the seat of scoffers. There are people who scoff at the idea of investing in righteousness, investing in eternity. They scoff at it, and if we sit with them, we'll learn to scoff. But blessed is the man who doesn't. His delight is in the law of the Lord. Liberty for life through the law of the Lord. And on his law he meditates day and night. He's like a tree planted by streams of water that yields its fruit in its season, and its leaf does not wither. Here we go. In all that he does, he prospers. The wicked are not so, but are like chaff that the wind drives away. Blessed is the man who seeks the prosperity that God brought us into the world for us to experience and gives us seed, enough to eat, and more seed if we will use it for his purposes, which is our Christ-likeness and the Christ-likeness of others through our influence. This is what Paul had in mind when he wrote to the Romans. Don't be conformed to this world. Don't use the stuff you've got the way the world teaches you to use it, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind that by testing you may discern what is the will of God, what's good and acceptable and perfect. Catch on to the good and acceptable and perfect will of God by changing our mindset and recognizing it's a harvest of Christ-likeness that God has in mind for us, and that's why he's given us all the stuff we have. And that leads me to the action that we get started in this series with. Action A, just one action today. I'm giving you one thing that I'd love you to wholeheartedly apply yourself to this week. And I'd love you to come back and see what happens next week. Here's the action for those who believe this principle, that God has given you what you've given that you can sow for a harvest of righteousness. Action A, decide how much of a harvest you desire. I'd love you to spend a week praying about this, thinking about this, and talking to each other about this. How much of a harvest do we desire? Are we interested in being more than simply eaters of bread, you know, enjoyers of the life we live? Are we happy enough with being simply consumers that we will be glad to spend the rest of our lives just consuming the stuff that God has brought into our lives? Or would we like to be more than just a consumer, an eater of bread? Would we desire to be, in addition, a seed sower, a harvester, which is to say more like Christ? He was a sower. He didn't have much money, apparently, but he had a lot of abilities. He had some time. He had some energy. He had some opportunity, and he took it to bring about a harvest of righteousness. And this is the question. How much of that sort of harvest do you desire? Paul the Apostle says, here it is again, it's God's intention, verses 8 to 10, that we abound in every good work and that we increase the harvest of our righteousness. I have been running home on my run. I run 3 or 4 days a week. I've been running home through the little village of Arva this year, because I moved closer to it, so I go through Arva. Charming little village. And Arva only has one intersection, and on the southwest corner of the intersection, there is a church, and behind the church, there's a cemetery. St. John's Interdenominational Cemetery behind St. John's Anglican Church. And I run through Arva on my way home, so I cut through the cemetery. There's a little dirt path, right angle, and I do walk breaks, so I walk through the cemetery. This unnerves my wife, but I'll share it with you. Because as I've been walking through that cemetery this year, I've come to the conclusion that I would really like my body buried there. It's a great cemetery. So I'm sort of getting familiar with the place. So I walk through the cemetery three or four mornings a week, and I read the gravestones. And some are pretty bland, you know, it's just names and dates, and that's, you know, straightforward. But some of them are more interesting than that. You know this from your time in a cemetery. Some have little icons, little images of what this person's life was all about. And I, you know, hesitate to give too many details or a slant on the details, because maybe some of you have loved ones buried there. And that wouldn't be, you know, polite to disparage. But I'm talking about me, not them. There are some cemeteries, I mean, some gravestones in that cemetery that have horse heads on them, or whole horses etched. And there must be a lot of equestrians around there, because there's people buried there whose whole life somehow was summarized by someone by the silhouette of a horse. And I assume, you know, for some people, they were in the business and they, you know, maybe were successful in equestrians commerce, and so the horse represented their successful business career. And for others, maybe it was a hobby. But I get thinking about this when I walk through the cemetery. No slight on these people. I don't know anybody buried there. I'm just saying that when it comes time for someone to make a gravestone for my corpse, I would like something other than my hobbies to be used as a summary of my life. I mean, I'm set up as a sucker for this. Somebody could put a canoe on the gravestone. So, yep, spent a fair amount of time paddling this canoe. But I don't want that. You could put a ASICS running shoe etched in stone. Yeah, he jogged a lot. I've actually thought of what I want written on my stone. And I will not share it with you here. I suppose I might if you ask me. But I think it'd be nicer just to wait, outlive me, and then come up to Arva and see if the people who are in charge of my, you know, gravestone inscription agree with me that it's an appropriate thing to say. You know, maybe it's delusional of me to think that anyone would think to say that about me. But I know what I want them to say, because I know what I want to have lived for when all is said and done. And you should too. So here's the action. Desire. Decide how much of a harvest you desire. I'd love you to do that this week. A related question to this action of how much of a harvest you desire is how much we as a church desire. It's related because it comes naturally out of the sum total of what we desire. But the fact of the matter is, we will not be much of a church, and we will not harvest much righteousness unless a whole lot of us here earnestly desire to harvest righteousness, to harvest Christ-likeness, and then get effective in doing that, which is what the next couple of weeks are going to be about. But if we as followers of Christ, so we as a church of Christ, are serious about a harvest of righteousness, serious enough to change the way we use our Mateo, then our lives will change, and our church will change, and London will change, and a place in Peru will change because we're investing in that, and other places in the world will change as well. And I hope very much to be a part of that harvest, and I think many of you desire to be a part of that harvest as well, though it has intimidating implications about what you do with your money and your abilities and your time and your energy and your opportunities. I just need to say, as I wind this thing down and send you home or to the gym for coffee and fellowship and debriefing, that there's a memo in the bulletin from the Board of Elders. And this is a heads up that they prayerfully came to the conclusion you need to know about what's happening this year, and it's not very happy. It's about cutbacks to the budget that have already been experienced since we tracked the first 3 months of the year. We expected we need an increase in giving. In fact, we don't have an increase. We're trailing our expectations, and that's not good news. And so the board directed the staff to cut back on expenditures, and we have decided, the staff, following instructions from the board, have decided to strive to do less this year than we thought we would do in terms of ministry programs. It was a painful thing to do, and we did it because it was the right thing to be told to do. But the memo serves notice that if the giving does not change, they will instruct us again to go back for another 5% cut another $30,000 out of the budget. That will mean laying off the part-time staff, the admin assistants, and the ministry leaders that our full-time staff uses to allow them to focus more deliberately on the ministries that we have hired them, called them, appointed them to do. And the memo explains the other reality. We need to give you the heads up on this, not to be alarmist, but to be fair to you who are part of this church and love what we're doing. If the giving does not change through the summer as we assume the mortgage, which is non-negotiable, then we've got to go after the only other negotiable expense, which is the salaries of the full-time staff. And there will be changes made to the full-time staff. And I tremble to think of us as a church having to face that, for what it would mean to the church as a whole, for what it would mean to the morale of the department that's hit by the layoff. This is where we are. This is where we are as a church. And I kind of hate to put this into the middle of this series, but these two things have coincided. I mean, the series is motivated by us becoming a more effective harvester of righteousness than we are, and here we are becoming a less effective harvester of righteousness at the same time. And the board was right to say, we've got to tell the people, even though it looks perhaps like this is the whole thing the series is about, and that would be a misunderstanding of the planning, but there it is, and we put it before you. But the fact of the matter is, the more of us who join those of us who already have embraced the principle and are taking what God has given us, not just for eating bread, but for harvesting righteousness, the more that that spreads, the less this will be a reality, the less it could even be imagined. We have the ability already to be a much more effective harvester of righteousness than we are, and I'm zealous to see that happen. For the good it will do the community, and for the good it will be to us to be that sort of church. So here's where we're at. This is what is happening at West London Alliance Church, and may God lead us and guide us in our own deliberations in regard to what to do with the seed that God has put into our hands, each of us individually, as people who have been called to harvest righteousness. Will you stand with me? Let's pray, and then we're done.